You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It is 20:00 in Hong Kong, 13:00 in Zurich, midday here in London, and 4 a.m. in Houston. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program, a fight between Texas and the Biden administration over immigration becomes a fight between the U.S. courts. Then Senegal faces an on-again, off-again election that will test its democracy in a fragile region. After that...
We can't afford to wait. It's for 26 years we've been waiting. We shouldn't wait any longer. The threat to national security, they are real.
After Hong Kong Chief Executive John Lee successfully tightens the city-state's security laws, we look at how this might impact the Chinese-British relationship. All that plus a roundup of the day's newspapers right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. If you thought U.S. immigration policy was in disarray before, just wait until you hear the latest. Because a fight between Texas and the federal government over who has the right to limit immigration and deport asylum seekers has now turned into a bizarre legal argument between various tiers of the U.S. courts. The Supreme Court yesterday said that a Texas state law giving it the power to deport illegal immigrants could go ahead, while the legality of it was making its way through the court system. A lower appeals court then just a few hours later blocked enforcement of the Texas law and is due to hear arguments later today. Well, joining us down the line to unpack this web of legal and policy fights is Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute University College Dublin and a regular Monocle contributor. Now, Scott, before we actually get to all of that, we have breaking news just in the last few minutes from where you are. Ireland's Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, has announced that he's stepping down. What can you tell us?
Yes, the Taoiseach, the First Minister, Leo Varadkar, suddenly announced this morning that he is stepping aside both as Taoiseach and as the leader of the Fine Gael party. And this is coming just months before we're going to get national elections. We do not know why. We know that Varadkar told his colleagues in cabinet yesterday of his intentions. We know that the cabinet has been meeting with Varadkar to make an announcement within the next hour. But there was absolutely no indication, although there were rumors flying that a senior politician was going to step down, that it was going to be Varadkar. There's a lot of speculation here. I won't really want to go into that at this point before we hear from him. But what I would say is this causes real uncertainty for what you might call the grand coalition of his party, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, the two parties that have led this country ever since it became independent more than a century ago. And it may open a door for other parties, notably Sinn Féin, to get some basically seats in government after the elections, which come up in a few months.
Yeah, really interesting development. And as you say, not easy to speculate right now. We'll have more on this story, I'm sure, on Monocle Radio going forward. So for now, Scott, let's turn to the United States and get your help making sense of what's happening on immigration policy there. I kind of outlined this at the top, but let's... I guess at the heart of this very complicated debate is really just a fight over who is allowed to manage immigration policy in the U.S. Let's maybe start there.
Yes, and more broadly, beyond the issue of immigration, it's a question of the powers of the federal government versus the powers of the state government. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, and Republicans in the legislatures who are really politicizing this issue of migrants and asylum seekers in an election year, they passed a bill earlier this year which said, we don't recognize, instead of the federal government having the authority for monitoring, enforcing laws regarding migration, regarding asylum seekers, instead of that being Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, we are going to do this through our own state policing agencies. It was similar to something that Arizona did more than a decade ago, which was struck down by the courts. The question of whether the state can do it has been making its way through the courts. And what you just referenced in the introduction is that while that debate was going on, the Supreme Court made the ruling, well, look, the state can go ahead with these enforcement measures, with the effectively defying federal authority and doing what it wants to do, while a decision is being taken on the constitutionality of the measure. So the Supreme Court did not say whether or not this was legal. They kicked it back to the lower courts, and the appeals court, which is going to consider the constitutionality of the measure, reversed the burden and said, no, until this is decided, and the hearings on this will be in the first week of April, until this is decided, the state cannot go ahead with enforcement. It remains as it has been for decades with the federal government and its measures for ensuring security on the border.
I mean, Scott, there's so many complicated questions around this, but in terms of this fight between the courts, how rare is that for the Supreme Court to say one thing and then a lower court to immediately overturn the Supreme Court's ruling?
Well, it's not, because it's not overturning, Chris, and I've got to be really clear in terms of what's happening here. And that is that the fundamental case is, of course, whether or not this is constitutional. And when the Supreme Court did not rule on that, when they effectively said, look, it's really in the purview of the lower courts for the moment, then it's in the purview of the lower courts to make the decision on what happens in the meantime. Had the Supreme Court said, we're going to take up the case of constitutionality, we're going to do it immediately, then they could have gone ahead and given Texas the power unchecked to seize migrants and asylum seekers. But two, and this was key, two of the six conservative justices on the Supreme Court said, we want the appeals court to rule on this quickly. And when they did this, Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, that opened the door for the appeals court to take the initiative, both on what happens immediately and then on the process for deciding, well, the ultimate legality of this measure.
But I guess then what is surprising about this is the fact that the Supreme Court, for at least a moment, said that this Texas law could go ahead. I mean, how strange was that aspect of this, even if they were, as you say, giving the lower court the option to kind of change that based on what they were doing? But how strange was it for the Supreme Court to say a law could go ahead? And frankly, how close were we to, say, Texas actually deporting asylum seekers?
Oh, it's not surprising, although this is a complex legal process, that the Supreme Court, the majority, did this and effectively handed the power to, or temporarily could have handed the power to Texas, because you are talking about, you know, six conservative judges, several of whom have expressed a fairly hard line in terms of the approach to immigration. They, I think, will ultimately hear the case, and I don't know if it'll be this session, if it'll be next year. But in the meantime, what they did is they raised an imminent threat, those conservative judges. You had migrants and asylum seekers immediately saying they were going to go into hiding yesterday. And you had agencies who help migrants and asylum seekers saying this is going to cause chaos and this is going to cause hardship for those few hours before the appeals court then said, no, let's get this back onto a solid footing in terms of the timetable for hearing this. And in the meantime, let's avoid the chaos. Ironically, or maybe not ironically, supporting the argument made by the three dissenting judges, the three moderate judges on the court, Jackson, Sotomayor, and Kagan, said we will not support Texas having this authority precisely because of the chaos, the uncertainty, and the shredding of the federal versus state question that it might represent.
Thanks very much, Scott. There will be more on this, I'm sure, in the coming days. That was Scott Lucas. Now here's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Seven sailors are reported dead after a South Korean-flagged tanker overturned off the west coast of Japan. Rescuers found two other crew members. One of them is conscious, while the condition of the other is unknown. The Kuoyang Sun capsized off Yamaguchi Prefecture after the crew radioed for help around 7 a.m. local time. Polish farmers are planning more than 500 road blockades today to protest against cheap food imports. Farmers in Poland and across the EU have been calling for changes to restrictions placed on them by the bloc's Green Deal. The plan aims to tackle climate change. The farmers also say cheap food imports from Ukraine are leaving them unable to compete. And the New Zealand government has announced it will ban the sale of disposable e-cigarettes to those younger than 18 years old and better regulate retailers. This comes shortly after the government received significant criticism for rolling back their world-first law banning tobacco sales for future generations. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Sophie. Now, Senegal is a nation that has been lauded for its relative democratic stability in the past, in a region of Western Africa that has suffered far too many military coups over the last few years. And while its current president, Macky Sall, has thrown that stability into question by postponing an election slated for February, protests and international outrage led him to reverse course, as well as courts for that matter, and schedule those elections for later this month while promising not to stand himself. What's more, Senegal's most popular opposition leader, Ousmane Sonko, has been released from prison. Joining us now to find out more is Tara O'Connor, founder and executive director of Africa Risk Consulting. Tara, welcome back to the show. This is a relatively good news story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think it shows it's a very good news story, in fact, and it's a great news story for democracy in West Africa, shall we say, because not only was Ousmane Sonko released to be able to stand in elections, but so were several thousand other political prisoners in a widespread amnesty law that just saw a lot of people that had been imprisoned for political acts, various political acts, but acts also that excluded the main contenders for the presidential elections. So it sort of ends a shoddy episode in the democratic history of Senegal.
And how will those many releases, as you described there, how will they impact the election itself, do you think?
Well, we're now racing headlong towards an election that is due to take place, I think, on Sunday, the 24th of March. Which was again due to be scheduled on the 25th of February. So it's a month late. And the new releases from prison have got to get straight into electioneering and to present their cases to the electorate. So it's actually pretty problematic for the candidates. Particularly, I think Ousmane Sonko is very, very popular in the capital and in some of the main towns, but in rural areas, he's still got to present his case. So it's not a done deal that he will waltz into the presidency.
So with that rush to campaign in the last few days, I mean, given that, I mean, how fragile has Macky Sall made Senegal's democracy, do you feel, with his attempt to postpone the election? I mean, have we kind of seen the last of that, or is this still quite a messy process?
Well, again, this is part of the cleanup, and I think it is quite good. It's also pretty much a victory for the pro-democracy young, you know, activists that actually put pressure on the government. They, you know, the people in Dakar are extremely politically active. They were active when the previous president, Abdoulaye Wade, extended his term to a third, attempted to make a third term presidential bid. And now it was popular pressure that really forced Macky Sall to back down on this decision and release people. So it is good news, but Saul, it does damage Saul's reputation, which has basically on the economic side is quite good. But on the political front, he has form in manipulating elections. He's repeatedly used his powers of appointment, extensive powers of appointments, to manipulate elections. And that includes manipulating the judicial process that targets his direct competitors with legal action to prevent them from standing in elections. And this case brings that tradition to an end.
Do we imagine that someone like Usman Sonko would be tempted to do the same thing when you talk about Macky Sall's reputation being damaged by this, but also his predecessor also trying to run for a third term? I mean, is that something that we have now seen the back of, given the sort of uprising, if you will, the protests as a result of this move by Macky Sall?
So, well, I think Usman Sonko represents a new generation of politicians. He's also quite an active anti-corruption campaigner, and you know, one of the reasons that he has been thrown in prison was because of allegations that he made about corruption against Macky Sall. So I think we are into a new generation of political leadership. But the temptation is there with the powers that are vested in a presidency under the constitutions of Senegal and a lot of West African countries. You know, the president has extensive powers of appointment and can direct the judiciary to some extent into carrying out investigations. And certainly one would hope that a new president would rise above it. But there is a tradition of this, of actually targeting the outgoing president. And it's a tradition that was set by Macky Sall to target the outgoing president and his entourage with sometimes spurious investigations as a political tool.
And just finally, Tara, I wonder if you could put it in a bit of a regional context, because we have had coups in the region in Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger. I wonder if you could describe what sort of makes Senegal special in that regard. Why has Senegal been able to maintain a democracy in comparison to some of these other countries?
Well, I think it goes back to Senegal's history. It has never had, unlike those other countries that have been affected by military coups, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, they have all got previous history of military intervention and overturning elections. Niger, for example, the real experiment was with democracy. It's had more military rule than it has had civilian rule. But that was very different. There's no tradition of military intervention in Dakar, in Senegal at all. So there wasn't really a concern that the military would step in. But one of the opposition leaders did describe this as a civilian coup. And fortunately, its overturn is the reversal of a civilian coup, that an overbearing president taking the transition of power into his own hands. But, you know, Senegal, the other thing about Senegal was traditionally Senegal was always the diplomatic head of the region. And so it's kind of got a very long-standing tradition of resolving its issues through diplomacy, internal diplomacy and regional diplomacy, which actually Macky Sall's, you know, cancellation of the elections also put at risk.
Tara O'Connor there, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle Radio's weekly world affairs programme. We tackle the biggest global news stories, as well as those too often left untold.
I've been out on the streets of Lagos. People are unable to withdraw their cash. Fights have broken out in banking halls.
As well as the occasional retelling of events from days long past.
The gates opened and in came this horse, absolutely huge, made of wood. People were asking, you know, what's it for? Is it some kind of icon?
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
There were a lot of diplomatic efforts by NATO and NATO allies. We really made big efforts to convince Russia not to invade.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle Radio.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. Yesterday, Hong Kong's legislature rushed through a new security law known as Article 23 that had long been opposed by protesters in the city-state. The legislation, which expands on a national security law imposed by China in 2020, prompted a wave of international criticism for essentially outlawing dissent. China has hit back today, singling out the UK and European Union for hypocrisy. Isabel Hilton is the founder of China Dialogue and a visiting professor at King's College London's Lao Institute. Isabel, great to have you on the show, as always. This law is ostensibly different from 2020's national security law, but how much does it actually change things?
Well, I think it certainly heightens things by several notches in Hong Kong. And it's also, it is an absolute marker of how things have changed since the 2020 national security law was rammed through. This, after all, was the measure that precipitated years of protests by very, very large numbers of people. Peaceful protests, it included the entire legal profession from 2013, when a clumsy effort to introduce it was essentially beaten by public protest. And this is the final nail in the capacity to protest. So, you know, there are 39 offences, I beg your pardon, with fire. It was treason, insurrection, incitement to mutiny, disaffection, seditious intention, sabotage, external interference, theft of state secrets. All of these are really loosely defined and could be applied pretty much to, you know, normal activities. A citizen talking with a diplomat, for example. You can be detained without charge for 10 days. The sentences for anyone found guilty of any of these very vague offences are savage. They're, you know, 11 years to life. And the other very telling thing was that there was absolutely no debate. As you said, it was rushed through. The Legislative Assembly in Hong Kong, which used to be, you know, reasonably diverse, there was debate, there was discussion. Opposition characters got elected to it in quite large numbers. That's all gone. So what we saw yesterday was just endless speeches. It was worse than the National People's Congress in Beijing, in praise of the party, in praise of the measure. You know, John Lee talked about it being a historic moment that Hong Kong's been waiting for 26 years, 8 months and 19 days for. I mean, it was really, you know, really Sovietic, to be honest.
Well, the UK's David Cameron, among others, criticised this measure very strongly. China, in response, said the UK should give up the fantasy of its colonial influence over Hong Kong. I suppose the question is, was there any such influence even left at this point?
Not very much. I mean, the whole, you know, national security legislation and China's actions since 2020 are in clear breach of what was an international treaty on the future of Hong Kong, which guaranteed Hong Kong's political and social order would remain unchanged for 50 years. China drove a coach and horses through that in 2020. And that meant that, you know, since Britain could do very little about it, it meant that its influence was already very low. So short of protest, which the UK and, as you say, the US and the European Union have all done, there's very little to there's very little room for the UK to change anything at this point.
And Isabel, I mean, you obviously described all of this and said, you know, this is a clear violation of treaties of the past. Is China even pretending at this point that one country, two systems is its policy?
Oh, it is pretending. It's in fact, you know, the coverage on the mainland of this was that this was a firm consolidation of one country, two systems, because after all, this is Hong Kong acting as an independent, you know, entity. Hong Kong's desire for this measure has finally been enacted despite foreign interference. That's the line in Beijing. So, you know, you're entering a parallel world, really, where the same reality is described in completely opposite opposite ways.
And just finally then, Isabel, I mean, what do we imagine then this does on the ground there, whatever China is trying to present in terms of Hong Kong's independence? I mean, Hong Kong was or is this international financial city with a mix of Western and Chinese influence. Will it remain so, or is that also kind of dead in the water now?
I think that's pretty much doomed. We've seen quite a substantial exodus from Hong Kong. Obviously, civil society organizations, human rights organizations, but a lot of media organizations also feel that it's no longer safe to operate in Hong Kong and have relocated to Singapore or Taiwan. As far as business is concerned, I mean, there have been very chilling moves on the mainland against companies that are doing, for example, due diligence for investors. And, you know, that kind of thing is very chilling for the kind of society that Hong Kong used to be and the kind of freedom that businesses had to operate. And most importantly, the guarantees that they have under Hong Kong's legal regime. And those have pretty much all gone. You cannot count on an effective legal defense now in Hong Kong because, you know, the party has taken over the legal system. So I think that, you know, this is hardly a confidence building measure. And I think that, again, it will precipitate further rethinking for international firms as to whether Hong Kong is still a safe place to operate. And at a time when China is rather desperate for foreign investment, it's not really the best move.
Isabel Hilton, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, it is time to have a look through the day's newspapers. Terry Ramsey is a freelance journalist and former features edition editor of the Daily Telegraph. He joins me here in studio. Good afternoon, Terry.
Hi.
Let us start here in the UK. You've got something from the Daily Telegraph. The HMRC is shutting a tax helpline for 6 months.
That's right, yes. The HMRC is the UK's tax authority, and it's saying that it's going to shut down its helpline for 6 months of the year.
Because none of us need help with our taxes.
Exactly, exactly. And they rather bafflingly say this is going to help the poor, beleaguered population. I mean, if you live in the UK, anyone will know that, stories of awful run-ins with the tax people and also trying to negotiate the labyrinthine website, which we're now all directed to. And I'm sure this is widespread around the world. So the idea that shutting down the helpline for 6 months is actually going to make things better seems a bit weird.
Have you ever used the helpline? I'm just curious, compared as an American myself. I mean, the US tax system is also unbelievably opaque and you have to file every single year, which makes it even more complicated.
Most people here have to file every single year, especially if you're a freelance. And I haven't had a personal experience, but my partner has, and they rang and had a long conversation with a tax advisor who at the end obviously was exasperated and actually said to my partner, "I don't need any more of this beep," and put the phone down.
Well, that suggests it's not such a bad thing they shut it down for 6 months.
Maybe the people on the end of the phone lines do need a bit of respite.
A little bit of respite and training, maybe, in customer relations. Well, let's move on to one other story that you have for us. Colditz Prison is reopening to the public. This is a story in the Times.
That's right. Colditz, obviously, is the most famous wartime prison ever, and it stands on a hill up above a river, so it was famously very difficult to escape from. But now you can go and have a look, and there are going to be tablet devices all around it telling you exactly what went on, and they've opening a lot of rooms that weren't open before, and they've actually got a map. They show a paper map that was produced by British prisoners there, showing the 485-mile route from the castle to the safety of the Swiss border. So as if getting out of the castle wasn't daunting enough, you then had to make your way across 485 miles of European countryside before you reach safety. I mean, it sounds like it'd be a fascinating place to go, but I kind of think that with the current fad for escape room fantasies, that the authorities have maybe missed a chance here. This would be the ultimate challenge for escape roomers around the world. And I'm sure there'd be queues round the hillside if they turned it into an escape room.
Absolutely. Would be very interesting. Also, just in general, though, opening a prison, I mean, this also in the US, you have Alcatraz in San Francisco.
Yes,
there's one in Philadelphia as well that's open to the public. So it's quite an interesting move. I don't know how common that is here in the UK to open up prisons to the population.
As far as I'm aware, there are no prisons in the UK open to the population. Some of them are quite open to prisoners coming out, but as we've seen in recent years, stories
of that nature.
But no, we don't have, unless you count the Tower of London, of course, which was a prison in years gone by.
Fair point. Well, let's move on to one other story. Kate Middleton, this is a constantly running story, obviously, here in the UK, and now there's reports that health staff have access to medical records.
Yeah, goodness. It just never goes away after all the photo fakery row. And now there's a story that at the London Clinic, which was supposed to be one of the most respected and secure medical establishments in London, that staff have tried to access her medical records, presumably to find out, you know, what this mystery operation was. And it's quite interesting to see the papers frothing at the mouth about this and saying how awful it was. It's in most of the papers, such as this front page lead and the Times and so on. It was unearthed by The Mirror, one of Britain's leading tabloids. And as I say, they're getting quite exercised about why would anybody do this. But I think actually the answer to why somebody might want to do this is quite close to home.
Massive speculation, and everyone is trying to figure it out, including journalists.
Exactly, and if you're a staff member at the London Clinic, you might see yourself making quite a lot of money by finding out what this operation was and telling the papers that are actually frothing at the mouth about it.
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit of hypocrisy there.
Exactly.
That will continue. Well, let's just go to one other story, Terry, that we might have some time for. I wanted to go to something lighthearted to end the show. Also from the Times, please, the headline, "No sex, please, we're Japanese."
Yes, that's right. And it's... So the story that half of Japanese married couples do not have sex, but also that there are a lot of people, even unmarried people, not having sex in Japan, and which is strange because Japan, to me, has always had quite a sort of sexually orientated culture, what with the bars that men can go to after work and so on, openly. But apparently, interest in sex has completely dropped off. Married couples are saying that their unions are nearly sexless. And what was quite surprising, or really surprising actually, is the remarkably high number of Japanese virgins among young people. So if you're aged between 18 and 34... which you would think would be prime time for a bit of sex. Well, 41% of men are virgins, and that's nearly half of men in their 20s and 30s are still virgins in Japan, which is quite surprising for us here in the sort of more liberal.
Somewhat surprising, although I have read studies here in the US or in the US as well that particularly men are struggling a little more, given that women are becoming choosier in the understandable rise of feminism.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. One of the explanations in Japan apparently is the rise of girly men, which are known as herbivorous males in Japanese. But girly men, they cultivate women as friends rather than lovers. They go shopping and they pursue in Japan what is regarded as a profoundly feminine pastime of eating cakes.
That is quite surprising. So men not interested in sex in
Japan. Right, yeah. And apparently there's a best-selling book about this phenomenon. And the book is called The Men Who Wear Bras and the Women Who Don't.
Interesting. One for readers to look up. That was Terry Ramsey. Thank you very much for joining us today. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was Monica Lillis. And our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.